Well, good morning. Good to see you. Welcome to Emmaus Church. I'm Nathan. Glad you're here. Raise your hand if you'd like a Bible or a page of sermon notes. And if you're over here to my right and there's a basket under your chair, would you take that and hand it down the aisle? And in these baskets are communication cards, little brochures about the church, pens if you need them. If you'd like to hand off a communication card later when we receive the offering, you're welcome to do that. The point of that would be just to kind of flag that you're here and invite us to put your name on our mailing list, which basically is a once a week, 3-point, 30-second type email that goes out to let folks know what's going on. And if you're here for the first time today, I hope that you'll be noticed by somebody quickly and that that someone will just graciously offer you a bag of coffee beans, which we like to give away. They're right outside the door. So if you meet somebody today, friends, make sure they feel welcome. Glad you've joined us if you're with us online, and hope that this is a meaningful time for you as well, and we look forward to seeing you back here with us in person. All right. It's great to see you guys. The closest I ever got to quitting ministry was 3 years after I started serving the church full-time. I was exhausted. I was already losing a sense of joy in what I was doing. I was already wondering how it would be possible to sustain a lifestyle with such consistent and regular and intense relational demands. Gratefully, recently, I had started meeting with another minister for spiritual direction, which basically meant we would meet, I would share my life with him, and he would just reflect back what he was hearing me say. And at one point, he asked me a series of questions that went something like this. When are you not with people? I'm always with people. People are it, man. That's what I do. I love people. I hang out with people. I have meals with people. I do stuff before school with people, after work with people. It's people. It's what we do, right? We're ministers. We're always hanging out with people. When are you not talking? I talk all the time. That's what I do. I'm like a pro talker. That's what I teach all the time. I lead classes. I lead meetings. I meet with people over meals, and we talk all the time. It's just what we do. We talk all the time. I'm on the phone when I drive. I meet with people and talk to people. That's what I do. When are you not busy? He said. I'm always busy. I mean, is it responsible to not be busy? There's always stuff that we do. I'm consumed with this. I love this. I'm doing this all the time. I take a day off, but normally I do something on that day off that's like, you know, like, that's when we get the chores done, or that's when we go shopping, or that's when we go do something fun, and usually it's with people. So, Father Tom said to me, you're never alone, you're never quiet, and you're never still. And what was it that you were saying to me? You're exhausted, you can't find joy, and you're not sure that you can keep going, you might quit. And this was like 20 years ago, and it seems really basic, but at the time, it was one of these moments when I was like, oh my goodness. It was like something connected, and I was going, I should really pay attention to this. And I realized, with a bit of embarrassment, that even though I studied spiritual formation in graduate school, that my spiritual practices were almost all outward. They were almost all public. I enjoyed group discussions more than personal prayer times, for instance. I preferred gathering with large groups of people to sing than I did spending time in silent meditation. And this had always been the case for me. I remember taking a class in college where the class started with 15 minutes of meditation in silence, and I could never stay awake. I was terrible at all this contemplative stuff, just awful at it. If it was repetitive, it meant it was boring to me. If it was quiet, it meant that it was lifeless to me. I didn't get any of it, and I was fine with that because I was an extrovert, I loved people, I loved Jesus, and I was growing. So it was working just fine for me until it wasn't. And I'm 3 years in going, I'm not sure I can do this anymore. And I realized, and this was late in my 20s, that there was a whole part of my soul that never really developed, that needed to be developed if I was going to have any ability to offer anything of value to anybody else for the long term. Like, all that exterior engagement needed to be fueled by internal development. All that exterior engagement, all that giving, all that serving, all that talking, all that being with people, that needed to be fueled by internal development. And so I went on a 2-day solo retreat where I was all alone. I didn't talk to anybody, and it was really hard, but something came alive in me that I don't think I'd really given space to since I was a little boy playing all by myself in the gully at my parents' place. And I was hooked. I was hooked. 3 times that year, it was when I was 29, 3 times that year, I went on solo backpacking trips for several days, just all by myself. It was like I was breathing the oxygen that I hadn't been able to discover anywhere else, and I was coming alive with it. And that's when I began to be intentional about this spiritual discipline called solitude. Let me recap last week. Today wraps up a 5-week teaching series that we've done on the topic of rest. Last week, we focused on corporate or communal rest, which is a practice of resting together. So much of modern worship is more of an event than a rhythm or a ritual, and the event that so much of modern worship or modern church gatherings is based on, frankly, is the rock concert. It's loud, it's intense, it's involved, it's big groups of people, and that's really beautiful and good, and it can be amazingly powerful. Another way of worshiping with other people, however, is to embrace silence and reflection together. This can also be good and powerful. It may be more challenging for most of us because we're just not as familiar with that kind of group gathering. We're not as used to it. We don't often get together with others to be silent and reflective. That's not what we do in our culture. But last week, we tried this. We read Psalm 46, which is a corporate worship song, in 3 parts. And at the end of each part is this interesting word, Selah, which most think is an indication for those singing to rest and reflect on the truth that they have just proclaimed. So for instance, last week we proclaimed, God is our refuge and our strength, an ever-present help in times of trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. And then we rested in that reality, in the reality of God's strength and the corresponding reality that now I don't have to be afraid. Because God is strong, I don't have to be afraid. And the line from the song that many of you are probably familiar with is where God says in the song, God says, be still and know that I am God. And it's really important to recognize that God speaks these words to a gathered community. And it's wonderful, and of course, God can speak to us when we're all by ourselves. But the context of these words from God, be still and know that I am God, are to a gathered group, a community of people that is learning to rest together in the presence of God. And so last week we taught and we actually practiced resting together, coming to God together to be still, to let go, to know that God is God, and to collectively come and to receive rest for our souls. Each week, I get 2 or 3 notes, 3 or 4 emails, and it's really fun and interesting because it's almost always from different people and it's about different things. This last week, I got more than the usual number of emails, but none of them were about the teaching. None of them are. They were all about the experience that we shared last week and the kinds of things that were unlocked and experienced through that. It was really powerful. So last week we engaged in this communal practice that leads to rest, and today to wrap up the series, I want to spend some time talking about a personal practice, a personal spiritual practice that leads to rest. My hope is that we'll just give you one really practical handle, one way, and really it's the main way historically that Christians have engaged in this invitation to experience rest for souls. And what is it? It's the practice of solitude. That's what it is. It's the practice of solitude. One of the most interesting scenes in the life of Jesus is the 40-day season of solitude that he spends in the wilderness or in the desert. This is right after Jesus is baptized. Three of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, say that right after Jesus was baptized, the Spirit takes him into the wilderness. Here's Mark's very short account of that scene. I'll read the baptism, and then we'll put the next scene on the screen. This is Mark 1, chapter 1, verse 9. At the time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice from heaven said, "You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." And here's verse 12. At once, the Spirit sent him into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. Now, sometimes the word wilderness is translated desert. The Greek word there is this word eremos, and it just means a solitary place. It means a lonely place or a desolate place or a place that is not inhabited. So immediately following Jesus' baptism, he is sent out into the wilderness, the desolate place, the lonely place, by the Spirit. Luke writes this, about the same story. Luke writes, Jesus, full of the Spirit, left the Jordan and was led by the Spirit, that can be even driven by the Spirit, into the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. So we see this critical event in the life of Jesus at the start of his ministry, which is this 40-day season of solitude. And we're going to come back to that at the end of the sermon. We'll come back to Jesus in the desert. What we also see in the life of Jesus is a pattern of solitude. And that's really interesting. We see this pattern of solitude first in Mark. So in Mark's very first chapter, Mark is the shortest gospel. He writes really fast. If you want to start reading something about the life of Jesus, you should read Mark. It's really rapid, and you can read it really, because 16 chapters. In the first chapter, Mark covers Jesus' baptism, Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness, Jesus' announcement of his ministry, Jesus' calling of his disciples, and this first big day of ministry where he's casting out demons and healing people. And then at the end of chapter 1, he says this, "Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place." There's that same Greek word, eremos, wilderness, desert, solitary place. Jesus went off to a solitary place where he prayed. And then I love the next verse. Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." And this pattern or habit of Jesus getting alone and getting away from his community and life and ministry, it just continues. In Luke's gospel, chapter 5, Luke writes, Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. Same word, lonely places, eremos, wilderness, desert, solitary, lonely places. The point is, this spiritual practice of solitude goes all the way back to Jesus, and frankly, we could find it practiced in the lives of the Old Testament prophets as well, but clearly Jesus models solitude not just as an event, but as an ongoing and regular practice. And throughout Christian history, solitude has been practiced, sometimes intensely, as a critical part of the Christian spiritual life. All right, so today I want to ask four big questions. We're going to move really quickly and try to just introduce this idea of solitude, which I know isn't brand new for many of you, but I don't want to assume anything because I think this could really be a helpful practice for us to engage in. First question, what is solitude? Here's a great definition. Solitude is the practice of making space for God. Solitude is the practice of making space for God by getting rid of as many other inputs as possible. By getting rid of as many other inputs as possible. A few thoughts about that. So solitude is not just the same as being by yourself. 100 years ago, if you were alone, you were alone. But today, if you're alone, you're with your phone. And so you're not really alone. when we are constantly communicating, constantly listening to something, constantly scrolling through images or news or games, we are constantly connected to all kinds of various inputs. So solitude is different from the modern experience of being by yourself, because you can be by yourself and absolutely not be alone. Solitude is the intentional practice of making space for God by getting rid of as many other inputs as possible. I heard someone say last week, there's a minister named John Mark Comer, who's got some great content about solitude. He thinks that solitude, and I'm not sure if he was quoting somebody else or not, solitude is more about what you don't do than about what you do. Thought that was very helpful. It is, in a sense, a discipline of abstinence. It's a discipline of fasting. Its purpose is not to fill the time and the space with lots of voices and information. It's to get rid of as many things as you can in order to make space for God. Another thought, sometimes in spiritual formation conversations, solitude and silence and stillness are talked about all at once, because they naturally go together. In other words, when you're alone, it's easier to be silent. And when you're silent, it's easier to be still or at rest. But even when solitude, silence, and stillness are grouped together, solitude sort of rises to the top as the discipline. In other words, as the decision that needs to be made. Luke writes, Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. So the decision that Jesus makes in order to create the silence that leads to the stillness is the decision to withdraw, to be in a solitary place, to be alone. Here's another thought. It's important to point out that practicing solitude is a critical part of the spiritual life, and so is community. It's not either or, it's both and. With solitude comes a variety of other spiritual disciplines, fasting, silence, personal prayer. With community comes a whole host of other spiritual disciplines, serving people, having meals with people, gathering for worship, singing together, teaching together. It's both. It's not either or. We seem to emphasize the community stuff because that's sort of what we do together, is we are a community. So we're always talking about the communal stuff. Both sides are really important. If it's rest that you need, however, and that's what we're talking about right now, right? If it's deep rest that you need because you're weary and burdened, because life feels chaotic and confusing, or because you simply are sensing you need a deeper relationship with Jesus, then I would agree with a long line of spiritual writers throughout history who believe that community is critical, but would say you should get alone for a while. Yeah. You should make solitude a regular practice. All right, so to sum up that first point, what is solitude? It's the practice of making space for God. It's not the same as being alone. It means being alone without all the noise that we normally fill our ears and our eyes and our minds with. It is a decision to withdraw so that you can be silent and still. And solitude is kind of part of the balanced diet of community and solitude. But we're including solitude in this series on rest because solitude is the individual spiritual practice that leads to rest. Solitude is a very specific and effective way to quote Jesus, come to me and I will give you rest. This is how we do this. Most effectively, I think, for most of us, we come to Jesus in times of solitude. All right, second question. What role does solitude play? In other words, what does this actually do? Different spiritual disciplines do different things. Like you might read the Bible for instruction. You might have a meal with somebody for encouragement. You might serve somebody else to grow in humility. Why might you practice solitude? What role does solitude play in the spiritual life? I think each of us would probably tune this in a little bit differently based on our own experience. For me, primarily, it's about perspective. It's about perspective. Getting away and alone for even an evening walk remarkably is helpful for me in terms of gaining perspective. I see things differently. I get a sense of the bigger picture. I make space for God, who ironically has been shoved out in all of the busyness and the responsibilities and the criticism and the deadlines and all the stuff in the day, I found that the longer my periods of solitude are, the wider my perspective becomes. In other words, I can take an hour of solitude and gain perspective on my day. And the few times in my life where I've been able to take days of solitude, I just get perspective on my whole life. It's really powerful. I start asking bigger questions, even about my own life. I'm often consumed with work. And this perspective is a very helpful practice for me. What role does solitude play in the spiritual life? For me, first, it's perspective. Secondly, it brings rest, right? I'm withdrawing in solitude. I'm taking a breather. I'm taking my hand off the plow, even for a short time. The times we read of Jesus withdrawing into a lonely place to pray are almost always after really intense seasons of giving of himself to others. So I think there's a very practical sense in which solitude facilitates rest. So first for me is perspective, second is rest, and consequently, and this is the third thing, solitude is often renewing. Jesus isn't going to a solitary place. Just make sure you get this distinction clear. Jesus is not going to a solitary place to kick up his feet and watch the game in peace. That's not what this is about. He's about communing with God. He's about a deeper and more focused communication with the Father. He's getting away to get space to be with the Father. And I imagine that being just critically renewing for Jesus. And I find that it's very renewing for me. Problems seem less overwhelming. Fears get put in their place. I am reminded and renewed in my love for people, my love for God, my love for the church, my response to my calling. What role does solitude play in the spiritual life? Like, what does it do? Well, for me and for many, through solitude, one experiences perspective, rest, and renewal. Still with me? All right, third question. How does this work? How does this work? This is the most basic thing I'm going to say, and it's the most helpful thing I was ever taught about practicing solitude. Before that first two-day solo retreat that I took way back when I was 29, after that conversation with my spiritual director, and he's like, "Do you ever stop talking?" He said this: "This is what's going to happen to you when you go be by yourself for 2 days, when you go away to get still." He said, practicing solitude and silence is a progressive journey. You're not going to like step over the line and arrive. This is a journey that you're going to take, and you're going to work through several layers of noise. And he drew this picture of several horizontal layers, which I tried to sort of replicate in your notes, and an arrow drilling down. And at the top, the first level, is just all the noise that's around you. Oh my goodness. I love my neighborhood. It's really noisy right now. There's construction noise. There's those blessed air blowers that everybody's got to use on their... They're just always running. There's the sirens. There's the barking dogs. There's the neighbor's music, whatever it is, right? It's all this environmental noise, all this sort of pollution. It's all the noise that feels distracting to you. It's unwanted noise. It's distracting to you. Sometimes you can't do anything about that. That's why people go away to be in solitude. That's why I go to the river in Auburn, or I go try to find a place that's more quiet. You probably also find, however, that a lot of that noise pollution is stuff you can turn off. You can turn the TV off. You can turn the radio off. You can decide, I'm not going to listen to a podcast. You can turn your phone off. You can get through or away from all this exterior noise, and then the fun begins. Then you get to deal with all the noise in here, right? All the conversations that are happening, all the things they said to you and the things you said back, and you wish you hadn't have said it like that. You would have said it like this. And these imaginary conversations that you have with people you've never met, or whatever it is that's going on. Sometimes there's accusations that you're making against yourself. Sometimes they're lies. Sometimes they're hopes and longings. Sometimes something comes up from way back in the past and you're like, what in the world is happening? And there's all these voices. I need, I want, I hope, you did. And you just have to work through that. You just have to let those guys blow out and quiet down. But that was so helpful for me to hear, because I could be 2-3 hours into a time of solitude and feel like, this is ridiculous. This is not working at all. unless I know this is just part of the journey. I have to get through this noise in order to experience what? Third level, like the still small voice of God. And that's a biblical phrase to sort of say the sense of assurance of God's love for you, or a nudge of direction. You should do this. You should do this. Some word from God for you, for you. That's why you went there, right? You are hoping for some sense of assurance of God's presence, God's love, some key to unlock the puzzle, something. And then finally, we get to like the bedrock, right? Which is the holy word of God. Which, in other words, we begin to experience what we read about in Scripture. We experience this reverent fear of God. We experience the knowledge of the love of God. We experience the goodness of God, who is before all things and in whom all things hold together. In other words, to go to those voice of God, word of God, what's the difference? Sometimes you hear something and you're like, was that God or was that me? I'm not really sure. God will never contradict his revealed word. And so sometimes we just chase that word of God, that voice of God. Is that God? And that's when we can kind of get to the bedrock, hopefully. And this obviously, or maybe not obviously, but this for me at least, this takes a while. So how does solitude work? There's so many things we could say here because it's pretty individual. But I think the important thing to point out is that solitude is a journey. It takes most of us a long time to get to a place where we can quiet down and then be still enough to experience God. Why is that important? Because it's from God that we receive rest. It's from God that we receive peace. That's why we went into solitude in the first place, right? Final question. This is the exciting part. Who will you encounter in solitude? Yeah. Think back to Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness, his first big experience, apparently, with solitude. We don't know much about Jesus' regular practice of solitude, the nights he would spend in solitude, the early mornings he would spend it, but we do know a bit about this 40-day season of solitude, and what we know is really instructive. Who will you experience in solitude? When you go to that lonely place, that solitary place, who else might be there? First, you're going to encounter yourself, right? You can't escape you. You can leave a lot of things behind and you can turn a lot of things off, but wherever you go, you're going to be there. And it's amazing where I have found myself. I found myself in a hike in the American River. I found myself in a kayak in Wisconsin. I found myself in this abandoned cave in Italy. I found myself in a monastery carved out of one solid rock in Ethiopia. I found myself in my truck driving southbound on 99. You know what I'm saying? Like, you think there's something else, and often what you encounter in solitude is yourself, and that is difficult. Most of us would do almost anything to avoid being alone with our thoughts. That's why we listen to music in the car. That's why we're never silent. Now, there's exceptions, but a lot of people have said to me through this series on rest, I hate being quiet and still. That's where it gets the most uncomfortable. We'll do almost anything to avoid being alone in silence. It can be difficult, but friends, it also can be liberating because I am forced to deal with what's actually going on with me. Like you, I have mirrors in my house. What do the mirrors reflect? What's going on the outside? Being in solitude is like going on a hike with a mirror that reveals what's going on the inside. You can't hide from that. Solitude will bring that out. I say my troubles, when you say, what's troubling you? I'll tell you about the troubles that are easy for me to talk about. But when I go out into solitude, I got to deal with the troubles that I don't want to talk about. I got to deal with the real stuff there. I get to wrestle with what's true and with what's not. I get to face what I'm afraid of and what I want to be. There's so much more I could say about this, but let me just point out that those who spend regular time in solitude know themselves really well. Those who spend regular time in solitude, they know themselves. If you go into the solitude, you're going to be there. And you know who else will be there? your adversaries. You will find them there too. One time I set up this weekend to be all by myself, and I was so excited about it. I felt like I moved heaven and earth to make it happen. And I go to this retreat house. I'm there all by myself. I get up early the next morning, and I'm on a run on the beach. And I cannot stop thinking about this guy who publicly maligned my character like 6 months earlier. And I'm running on this gorgeous beach, and I'm like, oh, heck no, you are not coming on this trip with me. You are not invited. I am not talking to you. I'm not thinking about you on this trip. I have other things. I have vision I need to get from God. I have perspective on my life and my marriage and my kids I need to get from God. You are not going to be... You know what he said? He didn't say anything because he wasn't there. He was in here, right? And he just ran with me for a while, and I just had to work that out. And that's the way it is, right? We just got to work that out. I was angry about that. Sometimes when I go into solitude, the people who are there are not the people I want to spend time with. Who's there? This punk is hanging out with me in my time of solitude. You will meet your adversaries there, and you're just going to have to work it out. You're going to have to battle it out. And this is a huge theme in the writings of the ancient desert fathers from the 3rd and 4th century. They go into the desert to face themselves. And by that, they mean their fears and their vices. And they go into the desert to face their capital A adversary, the devil. They go out there to meet the devil. Saint Benedict wrote in the 6th century about these desert fathers, and he says this: they go into the desert to grapple with the vices of body and mind and to engage, get this, in hand-to-hand combat with the devil. That's intense, but it's so, I mean, maybe you felt like that sometimes. You might think, if my enemies are in the solitude, why on earth would I go there? It's to gain victory. That's why you go there. It's to find peace. It's to come to a place of resolve and rest, to face adversity, battle through it, and then come to a place of rest. If you go into the wilderness like Jesus did, he's the model. His 40 days in the wilderness, that's the model. You will be there. Did God really say he loves you? You will be there. Your enemy will be there. And all these little enemies. And finally, God will be there. God will be there. And ultimately, friends, that's why you need to go. That's why you need to go. It's to withdraw from all the distractions and to make yourself available to God. Even if you don't hear anything, even if it feels 100% challenging, even if there's no breakthrough, okay, even if there's no word from God, even if there's no powerful insight, even if there's no brilliant idea, it is always worth the effort to make space for God. No exceptions. It is always worth the effort to make space for God. Sometimes as I begin a time of solitude, I am desperate. I am crying out. I am like, God, you have got to meet with me today on this hike. I need your assurance. I need direction. I need some direction for how to go in this. And other times I go into time of solitude. And I'm like, God, I'm here for you. This is why I'm here. I'm available. I'm going to hike to the river and I'm going to hike back. And I'm open. I didn't bring anything. I'm not doing anything. I'm just listening. It is always worth the effort to make space for God. Always. Two quick invitations. I hope you'll respond to this teaching, this super practical teaching, in just a super practical way. Two things to invite you into. One, I hope you'll go for a walk tonight. I hope you'll take a 30-minute, 40-minute walk tonight in your neighborhood, find some path, go on. Just go on a walk, just by yourself. And maybe consider making that a regular thing on Sunday nights or some other time when it works for you. I hope you'll do something today. Make space to be with God today, by yourself. And secondly, I want to invite you sometime between now and Thanksgiving to make plans for a day away, or a half day away. I mean, the American River Canyon is beautiful, and it's like 30 minutes away. Lake Tahoe, the beach, parks everywhere. plan a time to just do what Jesus did, withdraw to a lonely place and make space to be with God. And may you find rest in Him. Amen. I really hope this series has been helpful for us, Lord. And I thank you for this, just a sense of absolute, you should talk about rest and the wrestling match that came with not even knowing when to do that. When does rest fit? And I just thank you for some of the doors that have been unlocked in this season for us, and I pray that we would continue to press in, knowing it's always worth the effort to make time for you. We would come to you, Jesus, and receive rest in your name. Amen.